Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Whole Scoop. This is a health and wellness radio show where our guests are always highly credentialed in their fields, and the goal of the program is to present different and sometimes opposite perspectives to allow you, the listener, to make informed decisions on the right health approach for you. I'm your host, Carol Ferraci, a registered licensed dietitian, practicing over 30 years and founder of Naturally Nutrition, Inc., and you can find me at www.naturallynutritioninc.com. Remember, I tell you that I am a healthcare practitioner, and it's important for me to provide you highly qualified guests on a variety of topics to promote your own health and wellness. Tonight's show is absolutely no exception to that. We're talking about living with diabetes made easy. And while we're on that subject, let me remind you that our guests are highly credentialed, but it's always recommended that you seek medical advice prior to implementing any and all interventions discussed on this program. The call-in number is 347-855-8894. You can also direct questions and comments to blogtalkradio.com/thewholescoop. And you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Blog Talk Radio, which is always a good thing to do because we take all of your comments seriously, and we look forward to any show ideas you may have. So again, the call-in number is 347-855-8894. We will be taking questions later on in the show. At that time, I'll be calling out the last four digits of your telephone number. And if you are asking questions, remember to press the number 1 to get in the queue for questions. So with all that being said, let's talk about who our guests are. You know our guests. They've been here before. They're fabulous, fabulous ladies. Franziska Spritzler is with us. She's a registered licensed dietitian, diabetes educator, author of The Low-Carb Dietitian's Guide to Health and Beauty, who favors a carbohydrate-restricted whole foods approach to managing diabetes and insulin resistance. She works in private practice in Huntington Beach, California, and has been following a low-carb lifestyle since early 2011. Franziska is also a freelance writer whose articles have been published online and in diabetes journals and magazines, including Walgreens, Diabetes and You magazine, and Costco's Healthy Living with Diabetes. You'll find her at www.lowcarbdietitian.com. And I'm going to spell that only because sometimes people spell dietitian a little differently. So it's lowcarbdietitian.com. With her tonight is Lily Nichols. She's also a registered licensed dietitian, nutritionist, certified diabetes educator, certified LEAP therapist, certified Pilates instructor, whose approach to nutrition embraces real food, integrative medicine, and mindfulness. She is a regular speaker at medical conferences on gestational diabetes, prenatal nutrition, and exercise for pregnancy. You can learn more about Lily by visiting her popular blog at www.pilatesnutritionist.com, and you can also get her book, Real Food for Gestational Diabetes, at www.realfoodforgd.com. So let's bring these ladies on. Say hello. Franziska, Lily, are you with us?
Yes. Hello, Carol.
Hey,
how are you?
Hey, thanks so much for being here. We are on our second go-around with you ladies talking about this particular topic with diabetes, and we're doing a little twist tonight on we're kind of following up to what we talked about last time and just how we can make living with diabetes a little easier. But with all that being said, I just kind of want to recap a little statistics for those joining in for the first time tonight as to why we're doing this show, because if you're not familiar with diabetes or you just maybe know somebody that has it and you're kind of interested in the topic, you should know that 29.1 million people, or over 9.3% of the U.S. population, have diabetes, and 21 million people are undiagnosed. So the numbers are astronomical, and then even broken out by ages, 20 years or older, 28.9 million people, or I'm sorry, 28.9% of people 20 years or older we'll get that. We'll have diabetes by at some point. Now, the breakdown even goes a little bit further for by age and then men and women. It's pretty much split. So big numbers, a big topic, and it's pretty scary when you get diagnosed with diabetes and you say, well, what do I do now and what is diabetes? So, ladies, I'm gonna defer to you on just kind of giving an overview of what diabetes is, what pre-diabetes is, why obesity. People were talking about obesity and how it leads to diabetes. Just in short, just so we can bring everybody on the same page, get them to really be a part of why we're going to talk about how it's not as difficult as you might think to live with diabetes. Who wants to start us off? I'm gonna let you guys choose. Lily, you want to start? Maybe I just chose. How's that?
Okay. I'll jump in and start talking about pre-diabetes first of all. So most people are familiar with diabetes. It's a condition where your blood sugar is too high, and there's many different types of diabetes. There's type 1 diabetes, type 2 diabetes, and some other more specialized diagnoses as well. Most often in the U.S., when adults are diagnosed with diabetes, although we're seeing this in children now too, it's often type 2 diabetes, the vast majority. And that's preceded by pre-diabetes, where you're kind of getting warning signs that your blood sugar control isn't so good, but you're not yet at blood sugar levels. Sorry?
What would those be? What kind of warning signs?
Well, I'm saying more it's like the warning lights are going off in your car, kind of like, okay, your blood sugar is a little bit high, you need to get this under control, but your body is still able to, your pancreas is still able to create insulin and to somewhat manage your blood sugar levels. You're not necessarily at the point where you'd need an intervention beyond diet and lifestyle to get your blood sugar numbers under control, meaning you don't yet need medication if you're pre-diabetic. Most commonly, symptoms of pre-diabetes, the major risk factor is being overweight, because being overweight generally makes your body a little more insulin resistant. It's a little more difficult for the insulin that should be helping to keep your blood sugar at normal levels work properly. And so those two are very highly correlated together. But the nice thing about pre-diabetes or even the early stages of type 2 diabetes is that it's actually pretty reversible with the right lifestyle interventions, which I know we're going to talk about more today. So good food and moving your body and all that.
Great. Francisca, do you have anything you want to add to any of that?
Yeah, I wanted to say that, pre-diabetes is basically like early diabetes. And what's happening is, as Lily said, you know, your pancreas is still able to produce insulin, but it's actually producing a lot of insulin to keep your blood sugar levels at that pre-diabetes level. So you're producing more and more insulin. And over time, your pancreas does start to lose the ability to secrete that amount. Your cells are resistant to the insulin, and the pancreas compensates by producing more and more and more. And eventually, it's unable to keep the blood sugar within even pre-diabetes level, and that's when overt diabetes is diagnosed. And one of the problems is that many doctors, I think this is changing a little bit, but they don't really, even if they see the signs in lab tests, they may not tell their patients about that they have a pre-diabetes level of blood sugar. I've seen this many times. And so the person doesn't have any idea, and they just keep eating and having the same lifestyle until the blood sugar is so high that they actually are diagnosed with diabetes. But it's basically a continuum, and some people would argue that, there's certain areas in the pre-diabetes range that would actually be considered diabetes. It's not like a magical number, like here you are pre-diabetes and then you're diabetes. No matter what, you are still resistant to insulin, and you need to make dietary changes in order to control your blood sugar.
Okay, and I know we're going to talk about lifestyle here in a minute, and we're going to talk about living with diabetes, but I have one question, and the question really goes to medications. There are certain medications out there that will elevate blood sugar levels, and there are some that are directly attributed to creating or at least being a big cause of diabetes. Has that been looked at, ladies? I mean, what's the buzz on that out there in the medical community? Are they looking at that, or are they just saying, oh, well, now you have diabetes, and now we have to deal with it?
Well, there are certain medications, such as steroids and others, that can raise blood sugar. But to actually cause diabetes, it would have to be pretty – you still need to have some other factors, either a family history or lifestyle factors that would actually bring you to diabetes. Most people who just take steroids don't develop diabetes unless they have other factors involved. And I would say that most people who end up developing diabetes, it's not necessarily related to medications. But, you know, at the same time, there are some there is some evidence coming forth, or early evidence, that there may be things in our environment that are causing this increased risk of diabetes, and medication could be one, chemicals, toxins, all of those things. Yes, they're being looked at and investigated. I don't think at this point, with the exception of like Agent Orange that was used in Vietnam, I don't know that we have any definitive proof that diabetes is actually caused by either medications or preservatives or plastic. But yes, I mean, they can certainly exacerbate blood sugar control in somebody who has diabetes. And so that is being investigated.
Okay, great. Anything, Lily, before we get into this?
I agree with what Francisco said. I think there's a number of factors that taken together can increase diabetes risk, but it's hard to single out one and say that this is most certainly the cause. Lifestyle still ends up being the major contributor.
Okay.
All these toxins and things that are in our environment can certainly, damage our bodies. If they're endocrine disruptors, so hormone disruptors, we have to remember that diabetes is an endocrine disease. You know, it's a problem with the hormone regulation for your blood sugar levels. So anything, any of these toxins like BPA, the chemicals that come off of nonstick pans and plastics, like those things do contribute to hormone issues, and blood sugar issues are just one of them.
Okay. So all of that being said, and now I'm a newly diagnosed diabetic, and I'm freaking out pretty much because I'm scared, and rightfully so. I mean, it's kind of frightening to get that. It is frightening to get that diagnosis. And now what? Now what do I have to do? I know I need to change my lifestyle, and I know I'm going to talk to a bunch of different people that are going to tell me to do certain things. And should I be afraid? Is it really that difficult? What can I do? Where do we start?
Lily, do you want to go first?
Francisca, I'm going to let you go first.
Okay. Well, it is a scary diagnosis, but just know that you can absolutely, if not completely, control it with diet. You can greatly improve your blood sugar control with diet and exercise and other lifestyle modifications. And it's not a very stringent diet. It's not being hungry all the time. You don't have to limit yourself as much as you may think. It's a matter of really finding out what works best for you. And we can talk about blood glucose testing, but what works for one person in terms of the amount of carbohydrates they can tolerate may not work for another. It's very individualized. So I think the first thing to do is to, just kind of sit down and look at what you're eating. Because some people, when they're diagnosed with diabetes, they may already feel that they're eating a pretty healthy diet. You know, they may have cut out a lot of junk food and they don't drink soda and, you know, they're eating what they think is a pretty healthy diet versus somebody else maybe drinking soda and maybe, you know, in their mind knowing that they need to change. So it kind of depends on where you are to start with, but I think definitely focusing on whole foods is an important thing, and then balancing your protein, fat, and carbohydrates. Because just following a low carbohydrate diet, if you know you cut back on carbs, but then you're not sure what to do with the rest of the food, and you're afraid to eat fat because you've been taught that fat is bad for you, you're not going to last too long on that diet because you need to have energy. Your primary energy source is going to end up being fattier foods. But these are foods that you know and love. You may just have to adjust the ratio of the types of foods you're eating. And there may be some foods that you may want to, you know, cut back on or even eliminate altogether. But it's not a huge change from what you're doing if you're already following a pretty, you know, whole foods, healthy kind of diet. As I said, cutting out the processed foods and any soda and sweets would be the very first thing to do, I think, when you're diagnosed. And from that point, you can get a lot of good information by testing your blood sugar and seeing what you can tolerate with various amounts of carbohydrates.
Okay. And you know what? I'm just going to bounce back and forth to the two of you, so whomever goes first, the other one will always get a chance to kind of just jump in. So, Lily, feel free if you want. And if
sure.
you don't have any, go for it.
I'm on board with Francisco's recommendations as well, and I think okay. the something that her and I both emphasize a lot is that it's individualized. But one of the most important things people need to understand when it comes to the food component of it is which foods raise their blood sugar and which foods don't raise their blood sugar, because we a lot of people have a general idea or belief around what foods are healthy and what foods aren't. And sometimes foods that they think aren't healthy are actually the ones that won't raise their blood sugar. And the foods that you think are really healthy will spike your blood sugar like crazy. So, for example, I'm just going to choose something at random, but breakfast is a big meal that people tend to try to, when they try to eat healthier, they end up eating a breakfast that's going to make their blood sugar spike like crazy. So something like Raisin Bran cereal with milk and then like a glass of orange juice on the side, that meal, even though it seems healthy and there's a heart healthy label on the cereal box and maybe you're, you know, drinking low fat milk or something, that meal is primarily carbohydrates, which are of the nutrients, fat, protein, and carbohydrates. Carbs are the ones that convert into sugar in your body. And so those are the ones that are going to raise your blood sugar the most. So you might think you're making a healthy choice by eating that instead of something like eggs and bacon for breakfast, but your blood sugar numbers are going to tell you otherwise. And you almost don't even need to know any of this information, and you could just check your blood sugar and figure this stuff out on your own. But it is really helpful for people to kind of identify, like, okay, the carbohydrates are the foods that are going to spike my blood sugar the most. So I'm going to pay attention to my portion size of these the most, and I'm not going to worry about some of the foods that I may have traditionally thought of as unhealthy, things like eggs and bacon, which are actually incredibly healthy and don't spike the blood sugar at all.
Okay, great. So I'm going to go a little basic here based on what the two of you said. You know, we have everyone listening, different types of people listening. We have professionals listening to this show. We have non-professionals. We have people that are well-versed on the topic and other people who are just kind of tuning in because it's a topic they're interested in. So I'm going to go really basic here, and I'm going to say, just for all intents and purposes of the discussion, let's define a whole food versus a non-whole food, okay? So, and I know, Lily, you use the terminology of real food, right? And So let's go with whole food versus real food, and are they actually opposite? And let's just when we're using these terms, because I know it's easy to just slip into these terms because they're so familiar to you. How about we just give everybody a definition? So
sure,
whole foods with Francisca first, and then real foods with Lily.
Okay. So whole foods would be non-processed foods, the way that they came from nature. So that would be an apple instead of apple juice. Apple juice has been processed because it's taken the apple, it has removed all of the fiber and some of the nutrients that are found in the peel, and it's just juice. So it's been changed from its natural form. And the same thing goes with, like, certain meats, I would say. Obviously, meats have to be processed somewhat. You cannot eat the animal just, you know, as the way it is. You have to, you know, clean it and do some other things to it. But the minimal processing of those foods, that would be, to me, more of a whole food. Anything that's packaged, that comes with a cellophane wrapper, you know, unless it's an apple or something that comes, you know, that's been packaged in cellophane for whatever reason, for sales purposes, that usually is another clue that it's a more processed food. If it has a long ingredients label with anything, you know, more than a couple of ingredients, maybe a slight preservative on some of the more shelf-stable foods, that would be a more processed food. So things that are very familiar to most of us, things like crackers, most breads, and pasta, all of those to me are processed foods and not really whole foods. A potato would be a whole food. It's high in carbohydrates. It's probably as high, if not higher, than some pastas, but it is a whole food, especially if you eat the entire potato with the skin and everything with it. So a whole food is the way it was found in nature, or minimally processed, and not a lot of ingredients added to it.
Okay, great. And real food?
It's hard to separate and define the two in different terms, because I think they're both just common buzzwords that say the same thing. I would
and that's
say
okay.
That,
to make sure that we just pointed that out.
I would say perhaps, and I think this is where real food has become a lot more popular as a term these days, especially among dietitians. There's a number of dietitians who call themselves real food dietitians, and I think a lot of us, including myself, use that term because it differentiates us from the sort of what people usually think of as a dietitian, as somebody who works in a hospital and calculates calories and thinks fat is bad for you and portion controls everything really strictly. Like, that's sort of like the consumer perspective of what a dietitian does, and I think real food dietitians generally have a little more of a broad view about food. We're most of the time on board with people eating as many whole foods or real foods or unprocessed foods, however you want to describe it, and understand that there are benefits within these whole foods beyond just the macronutrients or the calories that are within the food. And I personally tend to think the real food label also extends beyond just the foods itself, but also how those foods were grown or raised. So how are the animals raised? What are cows meant to eat? How does that affect the quality of the food? Is this, you know, is this chocolate fair trade? Or is there, like, slave labor involved in how it's produced? What kind of pesticides might be used on things? There's a little more of a focus on the sustainability and the food production in addition to just the individual food itself. But I think these terms are somewhat ambiguous, and I think everybody can kind of define it however they like, but I think it encompasses both the whole foods and also the sustainability factor as well.
So, And I think that's an excellent point, because it's going to lead right into where we need to go tonight, because I think we can safely say that real foods coupled with real lives and real people kind of go a little bit better than a cookie cutter kind of approach that may have worked a little bit at one point, but now we're kind of looking at the whole picture, and that's pretty much what I'm hearing from you. That being said, I have to go basic again, and I have to say, all the points you just made, Lily, with you know, the environmental factors and everything else, and where how are the cows raised and everything? Why is all that important? That's important because if you just think on a basic terms, what we put into our bodies impact our bodies, and our bodies react to everything that we take in. If you want to use I always use the analogy of a car. You know, you don't put sugar in the gas tank because the car doesn't run. So depending on what you put in that gas tank and what you know, the type of oil that you use, or if you don't put oil, you don't put water where the oil goes and whatever, the car does not run efficiently if you use the wrong ingredients. The same thing with the body. And so if you know, you're going to constantly eat a whole bunch of sugar, your body's going to react. If you're going to constantly eat processed foods with chemicals that those foods are processed with that you can't even pronounce, well, your body's it's foreign to your body. It's not natural to your body either, and your body has to find a way to react to it. And one of those reactions can be, and I stress the word can, lead to diabetes. So if you guys, you agree with that? Do you think that's a fair statement to make?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And especially when it comes to, I mean, if we go back to one of the original points you made about chemicals or medications or things potentially leading to diabetes, I'm just going to pick a random example as it relates to the quality of our meat. Cows that are grain-fed and kept in confinement, they don't have as healthy of a lifestyle. I mean, they can't move and roam around. They're eating the wrong food, so it messes up their gut bacteria. They tend to get sick more often because their gut bacteria is messed up and their immune system can't handle it, basically, and then they require more antibiotics. There's often hormones and things added to the feed. All of these things that, you know, would make a human not so healthy, make the cow not so healthy too. So they're more likely to have antibiotic residues in the meat. There's lower levels of important nutrients because these cows are eating grains rather than eating grass, which grass is more, it's not as calorie dense, but it's more nutrient dense for the animal. So it affects the quality of the food, and it affects the nutrient levels of the food. So absolutely, in the long run, this would be one of many factors that could play a role in a person's risk of developing diabetes.
So, in other words, what we're actually saying, and remember the topic tonight is living with diabetes made easy. It's a very simple concept. Whole foods, going back to where we were long before we ever had these processed foods. The way our moms made it, the way our grandmothers made it, the way, you know, their moms made it, that's what we're talking about, and it's not that difficult. So that being said, I'm going to just do a little business here for a minute and remind people that you are listening to The Whole Scoop Radio on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight our show is Living with Diabetes Made Easy, and you're listening to Franziska Spritzler and Lily Nichols. You can find Franziska at www.lowcarbdietitian.com and Lily at the www.pilatesnutritionist.com and Lily's book at www.realfoodforgd.com. I'm Carol Ferraci, your host, and you'll find me at www.naturallynutritioninc.com. All that being said, we got that out of the way. Let's talk about just how we just did the whole let's go back to basics and talk about whole foods, but now what else do we do? Because it's not, you know, if I'm a person let me do this. I just saw a blog question come up, and I'm going to take a blog question real fast, just because it'll make the, I think this one makes the point. It says, we discovered diabetes in my 14-year-old son after he went into diabetic ketoacidosis. It's been a difficult adjustment, and can you talk a little bit about how to manage that? So now we're talking about ketoacidosis, and we can just do a real simple definition on that. But I think that is something that we need to talk about in terms of, okay, I got this diagnosis, but now my kid has it, and it's a little, you know, I've got ketoacidosis, and now what do I do? You might be telling me about whole foods, but should I be looking elsewhere? Should I be looking at other things? And I think, Franziska, you've got it down with being the low-carb dietitian, and you touched on it a little bit. You know, managing carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. How do you? I mean, everybody looks at labels. I can stand in a grocery store and everybody's looking at a label saying, oh, it's got this and it's got that. And do they really know what they're seeing? And what is, like, you know, maybe a real quick tip on how to look at a label, know what you're eating, and kind of just get an idea of what you should and should not do.
Okay, so this young man, he's 14 years old and was in DKA. So he actually has type 1 diabetes, which is, you know, it's managed very differently. This is something where he needs to take insulin several times a day. And unfortunately, I'm going to get into the food part, but when kids are, you know, in their teens, there's so many hormone levels that can affect blood sugar. So it's not always about what you eat. It can be a lot of other things that are going on. In terms of managing, though, someone that age who has type 1 diabetes, you still need to take into account the carbohydrate content and the protein content of your meals when you're dosing insulin. So it may not be, you can do whole foods, but the important thing for someone with type 1 is to match the insulin to the carbohydrate that you're eating, and also taking into account that the hormone changes. So it's very difficult, and probably something, beyond maybe our podcast today, to talk about much more than that, except in terms of how to keep him healthy, it's to make sure that his meals are very balanced and that he is getting, a small to moderate, I would say, for his age, depending how active he is, amount of carbohydrates at his meals, and that they contain both protein and fat, and that he's taking into account the protein as well as the carbohydrate when he doses his insulin. And I know, Carol, you were asking me about, like, when you go to the store to know what to buy for someone like him. It's still that whole foods thing. So, you know, fruit, apples, berries, low-sugar fruits versus juice. Juice, for someone with type 1 diabetes, the only reason to use juice is to bring them out of a low blood sugar. And that can occur when the insulin isn't matched to the amount of carbohydrates. So it's a little more complicated than it would be for somebody with type 2 diabetes, because it is so much more the medication as well as just the food that he's eating. But I would say at this age, he's in a good position to have lifelong habits that will help his blood sugar control and decrease his risk for diabetes complications in the future. Because there's people with type 1 diabetes, if you manage and keep your blood sugar levels within normal to slightly higher ranges at his age and can keep that going forward, he can reduce his risk greatly of complications in the future. So I think that is the key, is monitoring blood sugar control and just making sure that his diet is varied. Again, this is just a little more difficult than most of the people that we're talking about. But yeah.
Yeah, no, and you know what? I read that question. I saw it come through because I know that it's more difficult, but at the same time, it's doable, and it's doable by virtue of understanding it and understanding specifically how best to do that. So I'm going to tell this person that, again, you know, we always start the show with, it's always best to seek medical advice. At this point, with this type of situation, you should seek medical advice to manage what's best for your son. But at the same time, we're going to give you tips on how to recognize the whole foods and what to do with different things just to manage, in general, blood sugar levels. So that's pretty much why I bring that up. So thank you. And thank you for the question. It's very much appreciated. All that being said, Lily, did you want to add anything to any of that?
Sure. Well, Franziska kind of said what I would have also wanted to say about type 1 diabetes. I know you had a question about what people should look for on nutrition labels. Would you like me to go into that?
Yeah, sure. That'd be great. Because you know what? Even though that is that particular situation is a little more complicated, we can still give out some good general information for everybody, including this person. And you know, I feel your, and I'm going to say to the blogger, I feel your frustration, and thank you for tuning in to listen. And you know, maybe we can kind of direct that process a little bit later in a different show on managing a little more tightly when you have type 1 diabetes. But at this point, you know, I kind of want to give some generalizations, and that will also help you as well. So, again, thank you. So go ahead, Lou.
Sure. So I'm going to give some different advice than maybe some people have heard about reading nutrition labels. I personally find, and when I'm talking about nutrition labels, I'm talking about if you look at any food product and you turn the product over onto the back or the side, it has that little panel that says nutrition facts with the calories and all the fat and protein and carbohydrates and all of that listed out. I personally find that most people focus in on perhaps the wrong nutrients, especially when it comes to managing diabetes. I think a lot of us have been really ingrained with this idea that we need to count calories and cut back on fat, and cut back on cholesterol, and cut back on sodium. And people look at those numbers, and those are actually the numbers that are like the least of my concern if I'm looking at a nutrition label, particularly with somebody who needs to control their blood sugar. So the number one thing, and if people are at home, have like a food product with them that they can look at, they can kind of follow along. I would have people look at the serving size. The serving size is what the company has determined is the appropriate amount of food that you should be eating. It doesn't necessarily mean it's the right amount, but it's what the company has chosen is the serving size. And the important thing about looking at that is that all the numbers below, all the calories and grams of carbohydrates and all that other stuff is calculated from that amount of food. So you do want to pay attention to what the company has suggested, because even if you eat more or less, you need to know how to adjust the numbers that you're looking at to match that. The second thing that I look at would be the total carbohydrate. And that's because, as we discussed earlier, carbohydrates break down into sugar, and sugar raises your blood sugar. It's as simple as that. So let's say a product is serving size is half a cup, and the product has, say, 30 grams of carbohydrates. Then you would know, okay, this food has generally a pretty good amount of carbohydrates, and it's probably going to raise my blood sugar. The third, or maybe third and fourth thing that I would look at would be the fat content and the protein content, not because those things need to be restricted, just because those things don't tend to raise the blood sugar as much. So if you have a food that has a higher amount of fat and or protein in relation to the amount of carbohydrates, it's likely not going to raise your blood sugar. Definitely not going to raise your blood sugar as much as something that has 30 grams of carbohydrate per serving and very little fat and protein, you know, maybe a couple grams of each. So that would be the primary thing that I would look at on a label.
That's an excellent point. Thank you for making it, because most people, you're right, most people will look at the label and they'll go, oh, my God, look how much fat is in there or how many calories in total. And proportionally, they're not even equating it to the serving size. And so the whole proportion of fats and protein to carbohydrate is a great point to make. Thank you. Maybe we should do a whole show on label reading, because I know that for myself as a dietitian, it's something I always have to get into with most people, because it's not as easy to read a label if you've never been trained to do so, you know?
Right.
Oh, thank you for that. So all that being said, though, let's just take the foods that you have in the home, and let's just walk through a scenario where, you know, yeah, we might have a lot of processed foods, but we have a lot of unprocessed, natural, whole foods, real foods, whatever we're calling them, because a lot of people will use the word natural. I personally don't like the word natural, but, you know, that's what most people will call it. So that being said, what would I do in my home as an average person who has maybe 2 or 3 kids? I know I have some processed foods because, you know, the kids are snacking and it's easy and I'm working and my husband's working and whatever else. What do I typically have at home to work with to maintain or try to maintain my blood sugar levels? Francisca, I'm going to throw that one to you.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of foods that you already have in both your pantry and your refrigerator. We can start with your refrigerator. Lily already brought up eggs. Eggs should be a staple that is in everyone's home. That's for breakfast, but it can be used also at other meals. Meat and cheese, vegetables, and we're talking about pretty much all types of vegetables, all types. I know some people are a little bit afraid of carrots because they're sweet and they may have heard they have a lot of carbs, and they may have more carbs than some of the other vegetables, but they also have quite a bit of fiber. And only the non-fiber carbohydrates are digested and absorbed and can raise your blood sugar. So that was another point also on the label, the food label, I wanted to say you need to take into account the fiber portion, because only the non-fiber portion of the carbohydrate is what raises your blood sugar. So vegetables tend to be very high in fiber and low in carbohydrates, so those are great. You can also use frozen vegetables. Frozen vegetables are a great time saver because they've already been washed and chopped, as long as they don't have anything added to them. And what's great is just about every grocery store, no matter where you are, has lots of like quick frozen vegetables that are already cleaned. You can use for stir fries or for sauteing with a little bit of butter. And that was the other thing is Lily had brought up, I think, or maybe we brought it up last time, that butter is okay to use. And that's another, so a lot of people are afraid of using it because they've heard that butter is bad. And they switched to margarine years ago, but we found that actually butter is much healthier because the processed oils create inflammation. They can actually increase your risk for heart disease. So butter is a good fat. Coconut oil is something you can use as well for cooking, and that is actually kept in your pantry rather than your refrigerator. And then as far as fruits go, berries are the best because they're the lowest in sugar and the highest in fiber, but small apples and other small fruits that aren't very sweet, so like a small orange or cuties, those would be fine. Melon, the one that I would say to stay away from, the one fruit, is bananas because they're extremely sweet. They don't have a lot of water, so they're concentrated in sugar. And I know most people love bananas and think they're very healthy, and they do have potassium, but there's a lot of other foods that have more potassium and a lot less sugar and aren't going to raise your blood sugar as high. You know, things like avocado, that's another thing. People are afraid of avocados sometimes because they're high in fat, but they're very, very healthy. Fat is good for you, and the type of fat that's in avocado is a natural fat. It's another one of those whole foods. They make food taste delicious. Adding avocado gives you a lot of fiber in addition to healthy fat. So those are quite a few things. And cheese, I don't think I mentioned cheese, but cheese, plain yogurt. Greek yogurt is best. It's the lowest in sugar. And not non-fat. Whole milk yogurt, whole milk cottage cheese, those would be other staples to have in your refrigerator that you probably already do have, and to keep on hand for making meals and snacks. And I'll let Lily take things in your pantry.
Okay, sure. Lily, you're up.
I think you covered almost everything, Francisca.
Okay.
And thank you for filling in the blanks on the fiber.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you mention nuts?
Oh, my goodness, I didn't mention nuts, and I do keep those in the fridge.
Okay.
But go for nuts. Go ahead.
Okay, you didn't mention nuts. Woo-hoo, you left one off for me. Nuts would be absolutely fantastic. Most nuts, they actually do contain some carbohydrates, but again, if you're looking at the nutrition facts on any of them, although it varies from nut to nut, they generally have a lot more protein and or fat than they do carbohydrates. So they tend to be a really good snack that helps stabilize your blood sugar rather than make it go up. So nuts are fantastic of all varieties. I guess I could just jump into maybe some snack foods that are easy to keep on hand, because that's one I get a lot of questions about. Many types of beef jerky or turkey jerky, or even you can even find salmon jerky some places. Those are a really great high-protein snack. Franziska already mentioned avocados, which are fantastic, Greek yogurt, string cheese. There's a product now called Quark. It's actually a German product. It's like a wannabe fresh cheese product. Maybe not wannabe. It is a fresh cheese product that's sort of like, the best way I can describe it is like cottage cheese that's been completely pureed, and then oftentimes they add some flavoring to it. But for people who don't like the sourness of Greek yogurt, Quark is a really good option instead. Cottage cheese, also fantastic. Hard-boiled eggs as snacks are really good. Vegetables with some guacamole or even with a little bit of hummus. Hummus will have some carbohydrates because it's made with garbanzo beans, and beans do contain carbohydrates, but it also has some protein. There's some fat in there from olive oil, so that's just fine. Things like olives are really yummy snacks. Berries with whipped cream. I mean, you can eat fat and not have your blood sugar go up. And that's something that a lot of people don't realize. So you can kind of indulge in some really tasty foods. Bacon, these things don't raise our blood sugar too much. So there's a lot of really tasty foods out there that we can feel good about eating, whether or not we have diabetes, and know that our blood sugar is going to be happy as well.
And these are foods that most people are familiar with and they have in their homes at some point, whether they have all of these at the same time or they have the majority of them. I mean, they're easy foods for people to recognize. It's not a foreign situation where they've got to go. I know when I work with people on food sensitivities and we talk about alternative grains and we talk about different types of situations, then I have to send them to specialty grocery stores like Whole Foods or whatever and maybe even do a whole educational experience as it relates to that. We're not talking about that now. We're talking about basic foods that most people keep on a daily basis, and how they can actually help maintain your blood sugar levels. All of that information, Franziska, you got some recipes for us that are easy to use and manipulate as it relates to a busy lifestyle?
Oh yes, that's what I'm all about. one of my favorite things, and this can either be a snack or, you know, depending on the amount of cottage cheese that you use, you could have it for breakfast. It's super fast. A half a cup to a cup of cottage cheese, some chopped nuts of choice. So it could be almonds or pecans or walnuts or whatever you like. About a tablespoon of flaxseed, and this has to be ground flaxseed, because if you use the whole flaxseeds, they'll just pass right through you. But it's a very great form of fiber and omega-3 fats that are really healthy for you. And a half a teaspoon of cinnamon. And you can use a little sweetener. I actually do it without any sweetness, without any sweetener at all, because the cinnamon gives it some sweet taste and the flaxseed too. It's really delicious and super fast, very healthy. It's got a great ratio of protein to fat and carbohydrate if you use the whole fat cottage cheese. So that's a super easy either breakfast or snack if you use a smaller amount of cottage cheese.
That's nice.
Yeah, I like it. And then I have another one. This is something that I love to drink in the wintertime, and in the summer I do it in a cooled version. It's kind of a grown-up version of hot cocoa. It's called hot cocoa tea, and you use an herbal tea bag, and you just make it the way you would any other tea. So either peppermint tea or chai tea or a vanilla tea or whatever tea you like. You steep that for 3 minutes. You add about a teaspoon or so of cocoa powder, which is very low in net carbs and actually has some fiber and phytochemicals that are healthy for you. A little bit of sweetener if you need it, and about a tablespoon, a half and half. And you make that, and it tastes like a dessert, but there's no sugar in it. Very low in carbs. It's very satisfying. And in hot weather, you can pour it over ice and make more of an ice drink. But it's completely natural. It doesn't have, you can buy, like, sugar-free hot cocoa in the store, but it's usually got a bunch of ingredients you can't read, and it's been highly processed. So this is more of a natural kind of dessert treat sort of thing.
That's really nice.
Yeah,
I'm going to make it probably tomorrow.
It's good. It really is good. Lily, do you have any recipes you want to share?
Sure. Yeah, I have some recipe ideas. One that I love to recommend for breakfast is a crustless quiche. So you just make a quiche like you normally would. So that's like a baked egg dish. But instead of putting it in a pie shell, you just pour it in the pie pan as is and bake it. It's kind of like a frittata, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
But I like doing that with spinach. A lot of times I'll just get a package of frozen chopped spinach, let it thaw overnight in the fridge. You just open a slight hole in the bag in the morning, squeeze out any extra water, and you beat up some eggs, throw in the whole package of spinach, so you're getting a bunch of greens in there. Put in some shredded cheese, and I usually butter the pan, and then your salt and pepper, throw it in the pan and bake it in the oven. It's done in about 30 minutes, and you have food for the whole family. I also love a grain-free granola. A lot of people are missing cereal, especially since I work with a lot of women who are pregnant and have diabetes, which is also called gestational diabetes. They sometimes have they really have cereal cravings. You know, they're pregnant and cereal's, it's delicious, let's be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But it really spikes the blood sugar a lot, both in pregnancy and out of pregnancy. So I have a grain-free granola recipe that uses some unsweetened coconut flakes. They make these really large ones now that are nice instead of the thin ones that you might see on like a German chocolate cake or something. They make these sort of slivers of coconut flakes. Those are awesome to use, but you can use any kind. And then a bunch of different chopped nuts all mixed up, fiber, a little bit of maple syrup, only a tablespoon or two just for a little bit of sweetness, some spices, and you bake it in a low oven until it's dried out. And you can eat that just like you would on cereal or on milk. If you're sensitive to the carbohydrates in milk, you can have it on Greek yogurt. You could have it with almond milk, mix it in with cottage cheese, or just have it in a baggie as a snack. That one's pretty tasty. And I'll just throw out one option for like a lunch or dinner thing. Since I've been talking breakfast, shepherd's pie, which a lot of people are familiar with, it's kind of a casserole where you usually have either ground meat or some kind of stew meat and a whole bunch of vegetables cooked together. It's a very savory dish. And then there's a thick layer of mashed potatoes on top. You can make the same thing, but in place of the mashed potatoes, do mashed cauliflower. Or if you can get away with a little more carbohydrates, you could do half mashed cauliflower, half mashed potatoes as the topping. And you have this really filling, delicious meal that the whole family loves. And it really doesn't raise the blood sugar much, particularly if you leave out the potatoes entirely.
Wow. That's so creative. I love these recipes. They're fabulous. I'm gonna try them all. They're fabulous. Thank you, ladies. Listen, you know what? We're running low on time. I mean, it's amazing to me how these shows go. So we have a couple callers on the board. Remember to press 1 if you want to ask a question. We've got another blog question, and I think we need to answer this short and sweet, and then maybe get to a couple callers for a couple minutes here. Can the glycemic index help with controlling blood sugar? Who wants to take that one?
That's a tough one. It can. But it's not the glycemic index is only it tells you the value that your blood sugar will raise in response to one food. But we eat foods together, and it also only tells us for a specific amount, a reference amount of that food. So while we say low glycemic index foods, we're talking again about whole foods that have a lot of fiber. So those, regardless of where they fall on the glycemic index, because as I said before, carrots are something that are pretty high in the glycemic index, but yet the amount of carrots you'd have to eat to actually raise your blood sugar, the extent to which it would be damaging would be a lot higher. So I would say it's a useful tool in terms of, just kind of showing you a trend, but I would say focus more on just eating the foods that you enjoy, the vegetables and the fruits that you enjoy that are lower in sugar and higher in fiber.
Okay, great. Thank you. And thank you, blogger, for sending that question, and we appreciate it. We're going to go to the board and try the calls now. I tell everybody we've had some technical difficulties, so we're going to try this and see if it works. We're going to go with caller 4977. Hello, caller 4977.
Hello, Carol. Great show.
Hey, thank you. Okay, so we may have fixed the technical difficulty, so, hey, that's a good thing. So
right.
What can we do?
My question is, especially with a vegetarian diet, are there specific foods that would help keep the pancreas healthy and blood sugar levels where they should be? And another question, if I can, is it just in the American diet that we have these real high numbers for diabetes?
I can take that, or Lily can. If you want to take it, Lily, go ahead.
Sure. Actually, kind of funny. I just got this question today. So I'll take the first part with the vegetarian diet. Are you vegetarian in that you still eat dairy products and eggs, or are you strictly vegan?
No eggs. I do have some dairy products, just hard cheeses.
Okay, gotcha. So the challenge with a vegetarian diet with diabetes in terms of, like, managing your macronutrients is that most of the protein options that are vegetarian also contain some carbohydrates. So it just takes a little bit of finagling getting the balance right. So, for example, a half cup of beans has roughly 7 grams of carbohydrates and has maybe 15 to 20 grams of carbohydrates. 7 grams of protein and 15 to 20 grams of carbohydrates. Not sure if I said that wrong the first time. Now, granted, they are high fiber, but the way that most people would eat beans and trying to get a complete protein, you'd probably match them with another grain and then add again to the carbohydrate load that you may be having at the meal, where still the total protein might be quite low. So there could be a bit of a challenge just in getting enough protein from if you're doing more leaning towards a vegan, fully plant-based diet. I know you don't eat eggs, and for people who are vegetarian and eat eggs, that's an excellent option. They're high in protein and no carbohydrates. If you do eat some dairy products, that'll also be a great way to get protein without the additional carbohydrates. So hard cheese would be perfect. If you eat Greek yogurt or cottage cheese or that quark product I talked about, that would also be fine. Nuts are fairly high in protein and pretty low in carbohydrates depending on the nuts, so that's a great source. And also you might consider a vegetarian protein powder. So those have been, some of them can be made from like pea or rice, so they've concentrated the protein and the majority of them have removed a large amount of the carbohydrates unless they've added an additional sweetener to it. So that can be another way to work protein into your meals just to give you some flexibility.
Excellent. Thank you.
And then I had a second part of the question about diabetes rates around the world. I think the U.S. was leading the pack with diabetes, but we're seeing the numbers go up in other countries as well. So it's not just us. And it seems as though the more processed the food supply gets in general and the less people rely on local foods and are more relying on packaged and processed things that are shipped in, the diabetes rates are going up to match it. So we're not the only ones, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, yeah. And on that, I'm going to say thank you for calling. Appreciate
you, ladies.
And we're running out. We're out of time. So once again, powerful show, jam-packed with a whole bunch of information from you ladies, as well expected. That's why your show was so popular the last time. I'm sure we're going to get a lot of great feedback on this particular show. Please send your feedback to, talk to us on Facebook and give us some more suggestions. If you'd like to see Lily and Franziska come back, I'm sure that I would love to have them back. Ladies, if you're interested, we will do it again. So one more time, if you guys each want to give your websites or contact information, that would be great. So, Lily, you want to start?
Sure. Yeah, you can find me on my main site, which includes my weekly blog at PilatesNutritionist.com. For anyone who is pregnant, and particularly if they have gestational diabetes, or healthcare practitioners that want to learn more about a real food approach to managing gestational diabetes, you can head over to realfoodforgd.com, which has both my book and also an online program on the topic.
Perfect. Franziska?
Yes, my website is www.lowcarbdietitian.com, and I also have a book. It's called The Low Carb Dietitian's Guide to Health and Beauty, and there's a link to it on my website, and you can also just search for my name in Amazon and find it too.
Perfect. Ladies, thank you so very much. I want to remind everybody that we'll be back in 2 weeks on October 22nd, where we're going to be doing a show with Mary Ellen Philbin. She's the Chief Executive Officer for Share the Care. It's a not-for-profit organization providing services and education and training to and support to family caregivers. Lately, I've had occasion to come firsthand with family caregiving and what that's really all about. So we're going to look at that and kind of get some good solid information on how best to deal with that, because one in four households are actively involved in some form of family caregiving. So it just keeps growing. So we're going to be talking to Mary Ellen on October 22nd at 7 p.m. So come join us then. We've got some fabulous shows for the remaining part of the year. We've got another favorite show, another favorite couple of guests are coming back, and they're coming back together, and they weren't together the last time, so this ought to be interesting. We have Doctors Bump and Pache returning to The Whole Scoop to discuss managing pain medications and the vicious cycle that most people face as it relates to managing pain with medication. They're going to talk about alternatives to that, and they're going to talk about what to do if you're in that cycle alternatively. So that should be real interesting. And then in December, we're going to be talking about the health benefits of massage. And we're going to move back to January, where Tracy Stoffler's coming back. She's a third-time visitor. She's going to kick off the new year with fitness and health and fitness and why that's important. We kind of started this whole show last January with weight management and fitness, so we're going to kind of keep that theme going in January. And then later on in January, we're going to talk about healthcare advocacy as it relates to the healthcare reform. So we've got some fabulous shows coming up, so stay tuned. join us again, and thank you so much for tuning in and all of your comments. All of these shows are based on your comments and your questions, and I actually had a whole line of shows lined up, and I revamped it based on your comments, so please keep them coming. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time. Ladies, thank you.
Thanks, Carol.
Thank you.